Let's take a few minutes now for comments or questions or discussion about the two morning meditations.
Were you able to find yourself in your body?
Well, I think that it's much more important for you to answer that question than to answer that question.
When I think of the question, the image that comes to mind is that I'm, you know, an obsidian sphere floating in darkness someplace. And I'm not going to...
So being an obsidian sphere floating in darkness has a lot of darkness.
It doesn't feel dark. It just feels far away.
So what you're bringing up is actually a really important point, which is that many of us live in disembodied states, dissociated states. That is not the same as anatta. Yeah. And there are reasons why we live in disembodied states, dissociated states, so we don't need to give ourselves a hard time or punish ourselves or demand that we feel something different. We need to make a gentle invitation to actually feel ourself in our body, to come home, to feel safe enough to feel our body, to feel the wholeness of our body, to come home. To feel comfortable, to feel relaxed, to feel like it's okay to be here now in our own body. Yes.
When you were talking about your precepts, and you talked about non-harming, and talked about how we have this habit of being unkind to ourselves, and then you said in a very strong voice, "Stop that." And I was wondering, and also the thing of kind of like the image of the wallpaper and the sort of like the background, but I've noticed that it's coming more to the foreground. And I'm just wondering about the, I'd like you to say a little bit more about the stop it part.
Well, we can't stop it if we don't know that it's happening, okay? So to stop it is to take a lot of interest and to be really understand that it's not okay for this stuff to just go on as background noise, all right? You know, it presumes to be innocuous and harmless, and it's like dry rot, you know? It goes through your whole system and totally undermines your foundation. Okay? So to stop it is to make a vigilant effort to wake up to that it's happening and to not believe any of the associated thoughts and feelings and directives that are connected to that. So... because I trash myself, then I don't have to take care of myself. Because I trash myself, then nothing about what I think and feel matters. Because I'm just a useless piece of shit, then I don't actually have to show up for myself in any kind of a way. Right? That has got to be woken up to. We can't go on living like that. It's dry rot. It weakens the structure, the fabric of our constitution, you know. It's just, it's dreadful. And it's endemic. It's everywhere. And people do this so much that they don't even know that they're doing it. So the fact that it goes from background to foreground is fabulous, even though it's really uncomfortable. Because when it's in foreground, then you can see it. And when you see it, then you can have choices about how you're relating to it. Does that help? Yeah. Yes, please.
And a follow-up. Did you say last night that you thought that was kind of a result of the disintegration of the fabric of family and community here in the West, more than that situation exists in other culture groups that are more cohesively intact?
I think there are many different factors to it, and one of them is the disintegration of the fabric of community and family, and the other is industrialization. And so as we moved from nature, you know, farm agricultural societies into cities where there's concrete and telephone poles and timetables and schedules and not very much open space, we've lost contact with our reciprocal relationship with the earth that lets us know how wonderful it is to be alive. Okay? So we don't have the family support, but we also don't have the nature support either. You know? And then there's stuff about the Judeo-Christian kind of imprinting, you know, about original sin and the way people pick that up to beat ourselves with it. And, you know, there's many different factors involved. And, you know, I don't know all of them, but I do know that this is the result, you know, that this is actually the result of all of those different things coming together. It's not okay that it's like that. We need to actually have some kind of a recognition that this is not health and balance and well-being. It's not that. So we need to begin to deliberately bring effort to cultivate conditions that support health and well-being. You know, make an effort to connect with nature. Well, our first point of access with nature is our own body. You know, we all have a body. You know, none of us doesn't have a body. We all have one. You know? Yes.
A couple of observations. One is in going through the exercise of identifying different anatomical parts or fluids, that I had aversion to some, but not very much, and found that I really liked muscles and didn't have any particular opinion about blood, even though it's really important. And then to bring kindness after that was very helpful, because it's particularly for the parts of the body that I don't have any particular aversion or attachment to, it's such an easy way, a direct way to have access to having some, you know, opening that door of some gentleness and kindness. And the I kind of vacillated with the beginning image, and initially it was kind of this hillside that has every day different wildflowers on it. And I grew up on a farm, and it was very much instilled in our family to be stewards of the land. And I thought, okay, I really couldn't kind of experientially locate the body except in the mind. But concept, being a steward, resonates in being a steward of the body. Even if we have, you know, we buy properties, ultimately nobody really owns it. Ultimately nobody really owns the body, but there's the responsibility for care. So that I made kind of that translation from being a steward of the land to being a steward of the body.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Lovely share. Thank you. Yeah.
So much of our language that uses, you know, supports the idea that we are our body. We, this is my hand, or I'm going to reach for this object. And so I find it difficult in everyday life to not identify with it. That's about it. And yes, at times during the practice I can see how it's not mine really, but in everyday life it's much more difficult.
Well, I mean, we're up against quite a momentum. I mean, you know, there aren't any billboards that say, you know, you're not your body, you know, or contemplate the non-inherent existence of body. You know, we don't see that. That's not in the media. It's not on the billboards. It's not in our language. It's in Dharma books, you know, so it's a very thin band of the kind of input that we get is with right view. And the rest of it is that it is our body, and our body is somehow special, and that if we buy this clothing, then it'll be more special. You know, the kind of stuff that we get is very peculiar. But what you're talking about is what's needed to cut across the stream of impressions and views and the way our nervous system actually receives impressions and constructs a me and a you. You know, the way my eye is the, my eye, when I'm normally looking, I'm here and you're there. Okay, that's part of the nervous system and the way that it operates, all right? So insight needs to go beneath the superficial appearances of the way we normally see and recognize that, well, when I actually soften the focus, then the separation between you and me begins slowly to start to blur, okay? And there's color and there's form and there's shape, but there isn't a this and a that. The this and the that is what we do with the perception. But that takes concentration as well as insight to get to that. And most of the time, we aren't living with concentration. And most of the time, we are not living with right view. Okay? So it takes a kind of a recognition that to go against the stream is worthwhile, even though it takes effort, and that most of the people you're going to encounter are going to think you're nuts. Okay? So you need to be skillful in how you talk about it. Unless being nuts is something that is of value. Yes.
I thought that the way that you talked about the precept of refraining from sexual misconduct was really interesting and relevant, because in our culture, I think we definitely get a double message, and especially like from the Judeo-Christian tradition, and like, because in our culture sex is everywhere, but it's also seen as like something that's dangerous or forbidden or taboo in a way too, and like I think it's really confusing in practice and in daily life to be caught between those two worlds of being a sexual being, but also like having this fear that it's like very dangerous and like you shouldn't go there, but that is what your mind does anyway, and you know that deeply rooted desire, like being afraid of that because what you're told is that over and over again that that's dangerous and that it's wrong.
So this is rich territory, and I appreciate your honesty in being willing to open it up, because it's important, and it's probably a lot more common in this space than, you know, people are speaking to it. So you voice something that probably many others have felt but didn't find the words to express it, okay? And I can understand, you know, when somebody is caught in desire that's off the Richter scale, it's pretty strong stuff. And unless you have a very clear commitment to appropriate behavior, there are lots of times where people feel that this stuff is out of control. So I can understand how traditionally it was described in language that made it feel like it was really scary and really dangerous, because some people experience it that way, okay? remember, I couldn't believe this. I absolutely couldn't believe this. We were at it was in Australia, and there was an art gathering. There was an art museum that had set up a whole display on Buddhist art, and it was in connection with a very senior monk who was having his 60th anniversary as a monk. So he invited like 400 monks and nuns from all over the world to come have a birthday party with him, okay? And in conjunction, the Art Museum of Sydney had done this whole big, huge art display on art of Buddhist art, okay? So we were in a public space, and there were 3,000 people around, okay? And there was a monk, and nobody had offered him a glass of water. So I, innocently enough, went to go get a glass of water to offer him the monk. And the senior monk just about had a meltdown in the middle of the floor. And it's like, what is the problem? You know, we're in the middle of a public space. There's 3,000 people around. What are you thinking is going to happen if I give this monk a glass of water? And I duked it out with him afterwards because I was like, you have got to be joking. He said, no, monks lose it and they have sex and the whole monastery is forever banned because nobody comes and nobody off. I said, I gave him a glass of water. But that's exactly where his mind went, is that if I gave him a glass of water, the next thing is we are having sex, all right? So in his mind, there was an immediate sense that this is extremely dangerous and that this kind of contact is going to evoke that kind of response, all right? And it's like, I don't know who you're dealing with, but this is not relevant for me. And even if it's relevant for that monk, there ain't no way. This is a relevant conversation for me, you know? So there's a huge kind of thing that is actually the kind of danger that is involved. If you eat garlic, then the next you're going to be drunk on whiskey. You know, there's just, if you give it a millimeter, you are gone, okay? So I think part of that is actually complicated. Because it's been suppressed as well as excited, we don't have easy access to our own sexual energies, and when they are ignited, they're explosive, okay? And so it's like, well, we need to come back to basics of actually feel what it feels like, what sexual arousal feels like, feel what the edges and the limits are, know when our places are being in control and out of control, what they look like, so that we can step it back into areas where we still have choice, okay? And for myself, you know, Kundalini has been an issue of mine since I've been a teenager. And so this tends to also express itself in strong energy. And yet, you know, my precept container has been strong, you know. So there was a time when I was in the monastery and there was a man who smelled the Kundalini and thought I was personally interested in him, okay. And then wanted to make a party out of it. It was like, you know, lovely. And there was a time when I was really scared because the energy was so intense. It was like the fire was going through the ceiling and through the roof. And it was like, you know, this totally does not feel like this is okay. You know, this is not okay. And then I thought, well, what's the problem? The problem is that I don't think I'm supposed to be having these feelings. That's the problem. I didn't have any doubt that I would be able to keep my precept container. But I was frightened of the feeling, you know? And as a nun, we get all kinds of stuff about, you know, to break sexual precepts is the most shameful thing that any monastic can do, okay? So rather than worry about whether or not I was breaking the precepts, I was worried about having the feeling. And that is what we need to understand the difference. There's a difference between feeling and action, yeah? And because this whole topic is under the carpet, and it's not always easy to speak about it, and then the whole corollary topics of what happens with so many of us having been through situations which are abusive or violating, so we don't have access to our own internal energies because we've got a whole pile of trauma that we need to excavate in order to get access to it. And all of this stuff is like, you can't talk about it in a Dhamma center because it's not I don't know why, but it's done it to me. You know, I've been meditating for 35 years, and the number of times I've had honest conversations, or there have been honest conversations about this topic, I can count on one hand. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's going on? You know, why? Why is that the way that is? I don't know. But I think it's because there's so many people who really don't feel comfortable, that they don't feel comfortable opening the space and allowing it to be an open topic. But as far as I'm concerned, it's imperative, because I don't know how men work in terms of what goes on with your body energetics, but I know as a woman, if we are not connected to our own sexuality, we're not connected to our life force, okay? Because it runs through everything. It's connected to our capacity to give, to receive, to be awake, to be interested. It's connected to our create. It's connected to everything. So if we cut that, it's like we cut our jugular. It is vital importance that we are connected to our own sexuality. You get me going on this one. Let me hear it. To break for lunch, but I'll take one more question.
It's a good conversation. It brings to mind something that I think Ken Wilber brought up at one point, which is that, well, it's endemic in many spiritual communities, whether it's Zen or Tibetan Buddhism or not Buddhism, whatever, that there's often sexual misconduct between teachers and students. It happens all the time.
It happens all the time between the male teachers.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And what he brings up is that you can have a male teacher, or I guess I'll assume it's a male teacher, yeah. And they can have an experience of like absolute, samadhi. Like they can do all the bells and whistles of their tradition, but they never went back to the relative self, the relative sexual line or whatever. Like you talked about last night, if you don't do this, that sort of inner work. Mm-hmm. And you do the absolute, which brings to mind this juncture of like, okay, you have this absolute awakening, whatever that is, but the relative self is still, you know, has all these holes. And so how do you take an absolute truth, let's say like anatta, and merge it into a relative self? Like what you're pointing at all this time is like, I feel like, oh yeah, like, you know, we're not this, we're not that.
The way you do it is in relationship, because you can't see this stuff yourself, but the people you hang out with can, and your wife knows every single one of those holes, I can assure you. Okay. So you need to listen to what your wife says, and when she gets on your case about the kinds of stuff that you're missing, don't just do an absolute number on her that you're superior and you've got it all sorted. Listen. Okay? Because in relationship, our partners see the stuff that we don't see. They totally see it. And if you're in a community that has enough trust in it, the community will also see it. So that's part of the reason why it's really imperative that our practice is focused on community, that the community is like the central hub of our practice. Because that is the place where a lot of this integration can take place. But it requires that there needs to be enough trust in the community to actually go beneath the surface. And that takes risk as well as skill, as well as boundaries to navigate that in a way where people are not freaked out by what otherwise would have seemed like a transgression of appropriate boundaries. Because you don't talk about anything of real significance with people. We're going to need to break for lunch. Is that all right? Yeah. Okay, so what I'd like to do with lunch break is come back into noble silence to hold the container. So we've got quite a lot of goodies that are cooking. Yeah, let them. Don't release them, even though it's really, there's a lot going on for everybody and it's a lot to share. But just hold the space and let that stuff percolate through your own mind-body systems, okay? We'll have more times for conversation later today and then tomorrow at the mealtime. So there'll be more times where we can plug in these, not to cut off the questions, just to put them on pause, okay? Brilliant questions. Brilliant, yeah? Fabulous discussion. I find this wonderful. but just holding the container, coming back into silence, reconnecting with our own body, allowing the eating to be another meditation. Okay?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.